As you recall in Bible history, you'll remember that the book of Joshua is centered on the nation of Israel entering and claiming the land that God had promised them through His covenant with Abraham, all the way back in Genesis chapter 12. And this they have done. They've entered the land, they have conquered the existing enemy cities, and now they have divided up the territories as an inheritance to each of the 12 tribes of Israel. We get a summary of that in chapter 21 in the final three verses. Look at it with me if you would, please. We're in chapter 22. Just look at verse 43 in chapter 21. And here's the summary of it. The Lord gave unto Israel all the land which He swore to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it, and they dwelt therein. And the Lord gave them rest, according to all that He swore unto their fathers. And there stood not a man of all their enemies before them, for the Lord delivered all their enemies into their hand. There failed not aught of any good thing. There did not fail one good thing which the Lord had spoken unto the house of Israel. All of it came to pass. And so what we have here is that Joshua is summarizing here what is the organization of the new land that has been given and divided to the 12 tribes of Israel. And it's quite rewarding to see, once again, God fulfilling His promises. He's kept His covenant. He gave the nation of Israel rest. Not one thing did God fail to do that He said He would do. It all came to pass. The war is over. The land is inherited. The promises of God have been kept. And when we open up chapter 22, we find Joshua first addressing the tribes of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. And the very first thing that he does in verses 1 and 2 is that he commends them. Look at it with me again. Then Joshua called the Reubenites, the Gadites, the half-tribe of Manasseh, and he said to them, "Ye have kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you, and have obeyed my voice in all that I commanded you." Now the question is, what did Moses command them? What is Joshua commending them for doing in relation to Moses' leadership way before this? Well, he's specifically referring to the request that these three tribes made to Moses in relation to the land that they preferred to settle for themselves. I want you to see this with me. Hold your finger there in Joshua 22 and turn back to the book of Numbers, Numbers 32. And what we have here in Numbers 32, this takes place before Joshua ever leads the children of Israel into battle and goes into that first enemy city of Jericho. A conversation is had between the Reubenites and the Gadites and this half-tribe of Manasseh. Look at it in Numbers 32 and verse 1. Now the children of Reuben and the children of Gad had a very great multitude of cattle. And when they saw the land of Jazer and the land of Gilead, that behold, the place was a place of cattle, the children of Gad and the children of Reuben came and spake unto Moses and said to Eleazar the priest and other princes of the congregation, saying, "Ataroth and Dibon and Jazer and Nimrod, and Heshbon and Elali and Shebam and Nebo and Beon, even the country which the Lord smote before the congregation of Israel, is a land for cattle." In other words, before they ever cross over the Jordan into the land that God has fixed to give them, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh says, "You know what, to be quite honest with you, we kind of like it here. We enjoy this land. There's a lot of places for us to graze our cattle." In fact, that's what they said at the end of verse 4. "This is a land of cattle, and thy servants have a lot of cattle. Wherefore they said, 'If we have found grace in thy sight, Moses, let this land be given unto thy servants for a possession, and bring us not over Jordan.'" Now, I want to be a little bit careful here, because I know there are varying opinions as to the nature of this request, specifically whether or not God was okay with it. It's east of the Jordan River. It would be separated from the rest of the nation, and it would make them vulnerable to enemy attacks and influences if they settled there. And it does appear transparently that the basis for this request was solely personal gain. But we don't see God condemning their request any at all at this portion in their history. In fact, Moses actually enters into an agreement with them. Notice what Moses says to them after they made this request in verse 6. "And Moses said to the children of Gad and the children of Reuben, 'Shall your brethren go to war, and shall ye sit here?'" In other words, Moses just wanted to clear something up first. You're not asking to stay here so that you're trying to dodge war, are you? I mean, because that's not going to happen. I mean, the rest of the ten can't go in and fight the Canaanites and conquer the land. This is God's plan for us, and you guys enjoy your cattle over here on the other side of the Jordan. That's not how this is going to go down. Of course, they clarified it. Go down to verse 16 there of chapter 32. And they came near unto him and said, "We will build sheepfolds here for our cattle and cities for our little ones, but we ourselves, we will go ready, armed, before the children of Israel until we have brought them unto their place. And our little ones will dwell in the fenced cities because of the inhabitants of the land. We will not return unto our houses until the children of Israel have inherited every man his inheritance." We're going to go with you, Moses. We're not going to abandon you. It's okay. We'll set up our farm and our houses here. We'll get our wives and children taken care of. But listen, Moses, we're with you. We are still Israel. We're not trying to isolate or separate ourselves. We're on the same page. We're going to go to battle with you. And that's what happens. Look at verse 20. And Moses said unto them, "If you will do this thing, if you will go armed before the Lord to war, and will go all of you armed over Jordan before the Lord until they have driven out his enemies from before him, and the land be subdued before the Lord, then afterward you can return and be guiltless before the Lord." I mean, don't be shamed for this request, or before Israel, and this land shall be your possession before the Lord. So it's made clear, right? They would like to stay where they are. Instead of crossing the Jordan, Moses enters an agreement. Everything's laid out clearly. Fight alongside of your brothers as we enter the land of Canaan. And once the land has been subdued, you can return to the east side of Jordan and settle there with your family. And now we fast forward to Joshua chapter 22. And 7 years have gone by. 7 years of fighting alongside of the rest of the nation. Joshua announces that the war is over and it's time for everyone to return to their new homes. I guess you could say that they have received an honorable discharge. And the commendation is directly related to their keeping the agreement that they had made with Moses. They didn't abandon the rest of the nation. They didn't cower down. They didn't decide to stay there while everybody else went to fight. They did what they said they would do. Look at it back in Joshua 22 and verse 3. "Ye have not left your brothers these many days unto this day. You have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God. And now the Lord your God hath given rest unto your brethren, as he promised them. Therefore now, return ye and get unto your tents and unto the land of your possession, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you on the other side of Jordan." But not only does Joshua commend them here for being faithful to the agreement, he does appear to express a little bit of concern for them, especially about their faith as they settle on the other side of the Jordan, separated from the rest of the Israelite family. And so what Joshua does is he gives them a challenge of godliness and loyalty before they go. Look at it again in verse 5. "But take diligent heed." This is fatherly advice, isn't it? Joshua's being a good, if you'll let me say this, he's being a good pastor right now to these people. He says, "This was the agreement you made with Moses. It was done before the Lord. We're going to keep the agreement. But if I can just express my heart to you for a moment, be careful. Be careful. By the way, we got some young guys in here. This is wonderful. Don't be put on defense when dad comes around every once in a while and says, be careful. Just be careful. I'm going to let you do this. I'm going to let you go there. But we just need to remember some things. My dad is here, and I love the fact that we pastor together in the same area. Our churches enjoy doing a lot of good things and enjoyable things together. There are many times growing up in Harold Blankenship's home where Jared and I heard these words before we left the house: "Remember whose boy you are. I'm going to let you do this, but don't be messing with her, and don't listen to his stuff, and don't hang out with those guys." I mean, that's kind of what Joshua's doing here. He's being a good father. He's being a good pastor. He's being a good leader. Verse 5, "Take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, charged you. Love the Lord your God. Walk in all of his ways. I'm begging you. Keep his commandments. Cleave to him. Serve him with all your heart, with all your soul." So Joshua blesses them, and verses 7 through 9, off they went. And this is where we come to the main focus of the chapter, verse 10. Look at it with me. And when they came into the borders of Jordan, that are in the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, they built there an altar by Jordan, a great altar to see. As soon as they entered into their allotted land from Shiloh, these 2.5 tribes, they stop and they build a large, impressive altar. Now, some of you already know why this would seemingly be a problem. God had made it very clear that there was to be only one altar sacrifice for the nation of Israel. And that altar was inside the sanctuary that God had appointed. And during this period of time, that place was in the area known as Shiloh. I don't have time to take you there, but perhaps you'd like to write it down, do some follow-up on it later. You can look in Deuteronomy chapter 12, verses 13 through 14, and you will see the law that God had given the nation of Israel, that they were not to build altars of sacrifice on their own, that everybody was to go to the same place and the same location and follow the order that God had given for the whole nation. So because of that specific law, news has now traveled fast to the other tribes on the other side of Jordan. What had been done? Look at verse 11. And the children of Israel heard. They heard. Well, how did they hear? I'm sure somebody was texting or calling or posting it on Facebook. The media might have even been there to post a blog about it. Guess what Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh are doing? We knew they were the wayward children in the family. Going down the slippery slope, you know. We knew this was going to happen. I don't know how they heard, but they heard. Got back to them. And imagine their response. You know, it's like any of us when we hear that we've been let down by someone. Man, them rebels. I know it. They've fallen into idolatry already. They should have never made that agreement with Moses. Joshua should have annulled the whole thing. Their actions are going to cause God to bring a curse to our nation. I knew they were on that slippery slope, those stinking liberals. That's what they're saying. But verse 12, friend, is startling to me. Look at what it says. When the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered themselves together at Shiloh, notice this, to go up to war against them. Are you kidding me? They heard that something's gone down with Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. And their response is to get everybody together and pick up their weapons and go fight? Think about it. These are not enemies. These are brothers that they have fought together side by side. They're in the same family. They're in the same nation, the same brotherhood, the same God. And now their immediate response is, let's go to war. And my question is, are they right or are they wrong? Here's the answer. You ready? Yes. About all the politicians are doing today, I figure that's all I can give you as well. Now follow me. They're right in their eagerness to defend the holiness of God's true worship. Okay? They're absolutely right about that. If indeed that is what they need to do. They're wrong, however, in their immediacy to assume conclusions about their brothers on the basis of what they have heard. If it's true, then something needs to be settled. But if you're going to war on the basis of what you heard about somebody else, Israel, we got a problem. Now, let's be honest. We all have a natural tendency to assume the worst in others, don't we? And Ken alluded to it in the message. We're quick to jump to conclusions. And what's worse is that we presume that our conclusions are the ones that are exclusively right. That's exactly what Israel's doing. They've heard about something that's going on, and immediately they realize, hey, we're right, they're wrong, let's pick up the swords and shields, and let's go set them right. Let's go fix them. And because this is true of human nature, we are quick to take what we have heard or even think to be true about someone else and immediately launch out into battle. The problem with Israel's response in verse 12 is that the entire future of the Israelite nation is at stake due to their zealousness over the news. I mean, does that not speak any volumes to where we are today? I mean, even you guys that may not even be on social media, I mean, if you were just on there for 5 minutes, you'd realize that we're hitting something here. Brothers, pastors, church, cousins, moms and dads. I mean, going to fight against each other based upon something that they heard. If they launch into battle, there are enough Canaanites scattered throughout the region ready to regroup and attack them at the first sign of weakness. They don't even realize it. That the enemy is waiting on the other side, licking their chops, so to speak, just waiting for them to do some infighting, to turn on themselves. Because as soon as they turn on themselves, guess what happens? The enemy's going to gain the advantage. And they don't even realize it, that what they're fighting about is hindering the future of the whole nation. And the Bible has plenty to say about this. And you can search the scriptures out for yourself. Let me just give you one. James 1:19 summarizes it real well for us. Let every man be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. I get a bad rap sometimes. Now, I've already admitted to you this is one of my biggest problems. So this is not to cover it up as if it's not a problem, because it is a problem for me. I get a bad rap sometimes. My wife and I have two different personalities. When there's a little bit of conflict, she wants to duke it out right now. I just want to think things through for a little bit. You know, I want to make sure that I'm going to say the right thing, because I realize that anything that I do say will be held against me. So I'm just kind of one of those guys, whether it's with my wife or with our staff or with another pastor brother or whatever the issue is of the day. You know, my nature is to quickly respond. I mean, I wish you knew. God knows how many times I've typed up a comment or a tweet and then had to delete it later, you know. That's my nature. But I do have the tendency to just kind of slow down a little bit. Let me think through the angles and make sure that what I'm fixing to do is not going to hurt me in the long run. That's what James is saying here. That we need to be slow to speak, slow to pick up the artillery and go to battle. We need to be very quick to listen, to clarify, and to make sure that we're not doing anything stupid. Thankfully, there were some cool heads, as it were, ready to take the right approach. And this is what I want to get into, because what we see here is Phinehas, who's the priest here. He's leading the people to kind of calm down a little bit, to realize what they need to do. In fact, this is the outline that I want to share with you. How do we resolve conflict between brothers, whether it's a father and his son, two pastor brothers? Two fellow Christians in the church, whatever the case, a husband and wife, whatever. How do we resolve this conflict? How do we move forward before we destroy one another? Number one, notice that they involved spiritual counsel. They involved spiritual counsel. Look at verse 13. And the children of Israel sent unto the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh into the land of Gilead, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest. And with him, 10 princes of each chief house, a prince throughout all the tribes of Israel. Each one was ahead of the house of their fathers among the thousands of Israel. And they came unto the children of Reuben and to the children of Gad, the half tribe of Manasseh, unto the land of Gilead, and they spake unto them, saying. So what do they do here? All right, somebody spoke up. Somebody got them to, all right, calm down. Put your guns down. Put your phones down. Slow down. Turn the car off for a moment. We're not going to rush into battle. What we need to do is go over there together in a multitude of counselors and let's first evaluate what's going on. It's a very wise assessment that they're seeking spiritual counsel before they do something that's going to totally ruin the rest of the people, including their lives. And by the way, let me just add here, thank God for spiritual counselors who guide us through seasons of conflict. It is pride to suggest, men, that we can handle this on our own, that we are intelligent enough and spiritual enough and smart enough, that our conclusions are right, that our approach is what needs to be taken. No, it would be very wise for you, whether it's in a father-son relationship, a church relationship, whatever it may be the case, and get some spiritual counselors around you and say, hey, this is my problem. How do you think I should handle this? A multitude of my spiritual counselors are here today. I told you my dad, who has been a spiritual counselor to me in my life, our deacons, who I'm very and intimately close with, who help me bear my burdens and share my loads, and men that I'll sit down with after lunch today and share some things with them that I need their help with. They're spiritual counselors to me. I think about Tim Raven, who's here, who was my pastor for 8 years when I lived in Raleigh, who offered a great deal of counsel to me through seasons of life. That there's my father-in-law. Well, there's my father-in-law. And then there's no, he's helped me many times when I've wanted to quit, when I didn't know how to handle Kathleen, when I didn't know what to do, you know. Dad, I need some help. My brother, who has been my greatest spiritual advisor in my life, especially in the last 12 years, who has been a pastor to me, has kept me out of a lot of trouble, has kept me from destroying this church, from ruining friendships. I'm thankful for the counselors that God places in our life. But here's the problem. Some of us men are living on an island all by ourselves. And we're not willing to take advantage of the resources and the blessings that God has given. Listen, if you are struggling this morning, go to your pastor. Go to your friends. Invite that multitude of counselors into your life. They will keep you from trouble. They will give you wisdom in time of need. The Bible is very clear. Proverbs 24:6, in a multitude of counselors, there is safety. So how do we resolve conflict between brothers? We need to first involve spiritual counseling. Secondly, they spoke face to face. They spoke face to face. Look at verse 15. And they came to the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and the half tribe of Manasseh, unto the land of Gilead. They spake with them. They spake with them. I know we're living in a different decade, but it's a different century altogether. They didn't tweet about them. They didn't blog about them. They didn't run them down to their other people. No, no, no. Somebody was a spiritual leader in this group, got them together and said, hey, there's a problem. Let's go talk to them about it. And let's be honest. The way we most often deal with others is by talking to everyone else except for the offender. Jake is one of my best friends in the world. He recently told me in a meeting when we were together, he said, hey, so-and-so called me this week. I said, what do they want? They were asking me questions about you. You can tell them I'm still good looking. It's fine. Right? They want to know what you believe and where you're at and all this kind of stuff. I said, did you give them my phone number? Because they're welcome to call me. I'm glad to answer any question that they have. But that's not our nature, is it? Hey, what's your brother doing over there? Hey, what's Ken really doing in New York? I mean, to have 200 people in his church after 10 years. I mean, does he preach in a t-shirt on Sundays? Is that what he does? I mean, you're telling me he's brought the fog machines in, right? I mean, if we get to heaven and we realize that we could have used the fog machines, I'm going to be ticked off, all right? And let me tell you, what Phineas did here, was courageous. But it was rare. And what I've learned is that those who possess a suspicious spirit that readily assumes the worst in others is typically wedded to a cowardice heart that has no desire to understand another person's position. How many brothers have been divided and wounded because there existed within them no moral character or courage to sit down and talk and to ask questions and to seek peace? How many churches in this city, I'm talking about Charlotte, North Carolina, have been started because nobody wanted to talk out their differences? So what do we do? Let's just start our own thing. How many divorces have occurred in our lives because we don't want to speak? How many fathers in this room aren't talking to their sons and daughters? How many boys in this room are at odds with their dads? All because we avoid and we ignore and we neglect. And the Bible says if you want this conflict to be right with God, then man up and talk to them. See, the problem is that too many of us have weaponry in our hands ready to go to battle. And while we have weaponry, we don't have character to attempt reconciliation. Friends, this is Matthew 18:50. If thy brother shall trespass against thee, you go and you tell him his fault between thee and him alone. And if he shall hear thee, you have gained a brother. They involved spiritual counsel. They spoke face to face. Write down number three. They received the issue against them seriously. They received the issue. And I'm talking about the Reubenites, the Gadites, and Manasseh. They received the issue against them seriously. So what Phineas does is he comes to them and he explains to them that if they are building an altar for sacrifices, then they are inviting the judgment of God on the whole nation. Notice what he said there in verse 17. Is the iniquity of Peor too little for us? From which we are not cleansed unto this day, although there was a plague in the congregation of the Lord? But that ye must turn away this day from following the Lord. And it will be, seeing ye rebel today against the Lord, that tomorrow he will be wroth. He will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. Hey guys, don't you understand that if you go through and put sacrifices on this altar and finish what you're doing, then the whole judgment of God is going to come on our entire nation just like it has before? Notwithstanding, verse 19, if the land of your possession be unclean, then pass ye over unto the land of the possession of the Lord, wherein the Lord's tabernacle dwelleth, and take possession among us. If this is not going to work out, if it's a bad idea for you to leave there, then the best thing for you to do is to pack up your stuff and come back over here with us, because we'd rather you offer sacrifices at Shiloh than try to do it your own way. Because if you do it your own way and rebel against the Lord and rebel against us, you're going to have the judgment of God. He reminds him in verse 20, don't you remember what happened to all of us because of Achan? So there's some legitimate concern here. But what came as a surprise to those who were ready to go to war is that Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh agreed with Phineas. They actually affirmed the seriousness of breaking God's law and how if that was true, then yes, they were certainly right to confront them. Look at verse 21. Then the children of Reuben and the children of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh entered and said to the heads of the thousands of Israel, the Lord God of gods, the Lord God of gods, he knoweth, and Israel he shall know. If this thing be in rebellion, or if in transgression against the Lord, save us not this day. In other words, if we are sinning, then we deserve the judgment of God on our lives. That we have built us an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if it offer thereon burnt offering, or meat offering, or offer peace offerings thereof, then the Lord himself require. Then let the Lord bring judgment on us. Can learn something from here, fellas. Especially about what they didn't do. Their reaction was not defensive. They stood in agreement with the other tribes about the potential problem of such an action. And I want to appreciate the humility here. Because I'm going to be quite honest with you. When a brother in our church comes to me and says, hey, Pastor, I just want you to know somebody's upset that you said this or you do that. You know what my natural reaction is? I don't care about them. I do what I want to do. I mean, come on, don't look at me that way. I'm not the only one who does that. You do it too. You think I care what pastor so-and-so, what member so-and-so, what you think I give a rip what Jared thinks about what I'm doing now that he's gone? I'm going to do it my way. Even if what they're accusing me of is wrong, how dare they even come and talk to me about this? We are our people now. We do what we want to do. But that's not how they responded. They didn't respond in frustration. They didn't respond sarcastically, as if those tribes were completely foolish for coming all the way out there to bring this whole ordeal up. And brothers, we can learn something here. It's so important that when a brother brings an issue to us, that we treat the issue seriously and not foolishly. We've all had those moments when our pastors have had to talk to us, right? Try having your pastor as your father, too. This is double talk. I'm going to write a book one day that says, Pastor's kids are people too. There's one stage in our life where my dad was not only my dad and my pastor, he's also my principal. Imagine that kind of world. So many times, our reactions to confrontations, the way that we treat people for even bringing things to our attention. So some of you are a little distant from your pastor today, or one of your pastors, because you're ticked off at the thought that they even came to you and said, I'm concerned. And yet we somehow think we're supposed to grow in our spiritual lives, that we can go against the enemy without needing the partnership and the friendship and the accountability of one another. This is why God has given us this band of brothers. We need each other. And even if the accusations against us are wrong, even if our wife or our children or whoever brings things to our attention that we know is absolutely not true, that is not the time to rise up in anger and be defensive against what we perceive as foolishness. Humble yourself. Learn something from everything that is confronted in your life and let God use that to grow you closer, not into their image, but in the image of Jesus who He desires you to be. They took seriously the accusation. Maybe I should think about this. Number four, they clarified their position. They clarified their position. Verse 24 says, and if we have not rather done it for fear of this thing, saying, in time to come your children might speak unto our children, saying, what have ye to do with the Lord God of Israel? All right, so they said, you know what? We were thinking that now that we're living over here away from the rest of Israel, we were concerned that our children might grow up wondering, you know, where do we stand? Who do we belong to? Who is our God? For the Lord, verse 25, hath made Jordan a border between us and you, ye, the children of Reuben, children of Gad, ye have no part in the Lord, so shall your children make our children cease from fearing the Lord. We didn't want them to think that we were enemies, that we were serving two different gods. Therefore we said, verse 26, let us now prepare to build an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice. We built this as a memorial, verse 27, that it might be a witness between us and you and our generations, that we might do the service of the Lord. Therefore, verse 28 said we, that it shall be when they should say to us or to our generation in time to come, that we may again say, behold, the pattern of the altar of the Lord, which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings nor for sacrifices, but it is a witness. And so God forbid, verse 29, that we should rebel against the Lord and turn this day from following the Lord to build an altar for burnt offerings, for meat offerings, for sacrifice, besides the altar of the Lord our God that is before His tabernacle. And when Phinehas the priest and the princes of the congregation and the heads of the houses of Israel which were with him heard the words of the children of Reuben and the children of God, children of Gad rather, the children of Manasseh, they spake. What did they do? Glad we got that figured out. The eastern tribes weren't building an altar for sacrifices. They built an altar as a memorial. to remind their children that though they were separated from the rest of their nation, that we who were on the other side of the Jordan are still indeed the people of God. And we will continue to be a people who love God, who serve God, who worship the one true God. We're going to keep going to Shiloh. We didn't build this place as a place of sacrifice like the rest of Israel thought and initially accused of us. No. We built it as a witness to future generation that God is our God. They clarified their position. Well, they sure did save a battle, didn't they? Imagine all the bloodshed that would have happened. What would Israel had looked like for years to come in this situation had they not resolved the conflict? Brothers, we are called to be peacemakers, not troublemakers. The Beatitudes, blessed are the peacemakers. You know what that term peacemakers means? It means those who actively pursue peace. Not those who passively anticipate peace. I'm just going to wait for them to come to me, and I'm sure when they come to me, we'll have it all worked out. No, Phineas did the right thing. Boys, put your armor down. We're going to go have a conversation. Blessed are those who actively pursue peace. Why? They are the children of God. Let me give you this last one, and we're done. Number 5, they rejoiced in their unity together with God. They rejoiced in their unity together with God. Just real quickly, look at verse 31. Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest, said to the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, the children of Manasseh, this day we perceive that the Lord is among us. Oh, what a beautiful statement. Here were two brothers, confused, misunderstanding, one ready to wipe them out. And because they had a biblical, godly conversation, Phinehas said, the Lord is with us. Kind of reminds me of what Jesus said about church discipline, which is not primarily for the purpose of forsaking people. It's for the purpose of bringing unity among people. So the whole where two or three are gathered in his name, don't use that this week if you go to, you know, like 10 different services so you can have 50 people in your building and say, oh, that's okay, two or three are gathered in his name. That's not what it means. Two or three gathered in his name, that's church discipline. What he's saying is that when we come together to resolve conflict, guess what? The presence of God is promised to be there. It's very similar to what Phinehas is saying here. We feel the presence of the Lord among us because ye have not committed this sin against the Lord. Now ye have delivered the children of Israel out of the hand of the Lord. And Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest and the princes, they returned from the children of Reuben, Gad, out of the land of Gilead, under the land of Canaan, the children of Israel, and brought them word again. Hey, we got good news, guys. We were wrong. We were wrong. I think probably there are three phrases that we men struggle to say in our vocabulary. I was wrong. I'm sorry. Can you forgive me? Those might be the three most important phrases that you could ever have in your marriage. I was wrong. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? So Phinehas went back and said, guys, we were wrong. But we're sorry. We made things right. And verse 33 said, this thing pleased the children of Israel. When brothers are in unity together, it makes everybody else around us a whole lot happier. I get discouraged as a young preacher when I see pastor friends of mine fighting and tearing each other up. I'm a whole lot happier when we're just loving each other and getting along, and regardless of our differences and preferences, that we're just all in this thing together for the gospel. It's just a whole lot better that way. You know the old saying, if mama ain't happy, nobody's happy? I'm not saying that's true in my home. It's probably true for a lot of you. It's not true in mine because she's actually standing right back there right now. And we're always happy in our home. You understand the sentiment. It's the same thing about you fellas. Sometimes your wife's had a glorious day. The kids are in a good mood. You bring everything home and the cloud has settled in. Because when we're having a bad day, everybody else has a bad day. When you're fighting among each other in your church, guess what? Your church feels it. They know it. And we learn something important here, that when we are rejoicing in our unity with one another, when we are confronting, when we are praying together, when we are restoring and reconciling each other, it just makes everything around us so much more pleasurable. Here's the last verse, verse 34. I know you're ready for some barbecue. So many of you are calling right now asking. Hey, I can't do that on Sunday morning, but I can do that with you men. All right, 34, look at it. And the children of Reuben and the children of Gad, they called the altar, this is funny to me, Ed. Anybody here named Ed? I got an Ed back here. Got Ed? Ed! First time I ever read that, I thought about Mr. Ed, the horse, you know, on television. Like, did they carve the altar out of a horse and called it Ed? And I don't know, but here's what he says it means. This is helpful. Because it is a witness between us that the Lord is our God. It means witness. Ed does. It means witness. Their memorial was to stand as a witness of their unity together, though they were geographically separated. Jesus said it like this: by this shall all men know that you are my true disciples, if you love each other. I got a few guys around here, they don't like to use the L word with other men. They find it very effeminate. I got one fellow that's been here a long time. I'll not embarrass him, but I tell him often, I love you. I love you. Don't say that to me. Don't say that to me. He texted me the other day and said, Pastor, you're still my favorite preacher. I sent him a little emoji with a kissing face on it. He told me not too long ago, he said, Pastor, I love you. I love you too. We don't always agree. We have different preferences about things. But I'm thankful, though, that we are two totally opposite people. There's something wonderful about the love that portrays the witness of God's glorious gospel. When instead of isolating ourselves from brothers who are different than us, that we realize, hey, let's put down the weapons. We're on the same team. I like what Adrian Rogers said. We can be brothers without being twins. Man, I look at some of you and I'm glad we're not twins. But I'm happy to be your brother. It's one of the things I love about this group of churches that come together. I think on any given Sunday, we walk in our different churches, we probably say a lot of different things. Yeah. I prefer you not walk into Lakeside because he still needs support right now, so don't do that. I'm kidding. It's good. He's more conservative than I am. But you understand the point. We got a lot of different things around here. But you know what I love about this? There's something that's more important than those things. It's the gospel. It's our witness to the world. It's being a band of brothers. I want to close by giving you just five quick things. I'm just going to read them to you. Perhaps you'd like to write them down and we'll be gone. These are lessons that we can take home and consider in our own lives as we conclude this whole thought. Number one, don't assume the worst when you hear news about others. This is a part of what it means in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 to love. What does love do? Love believes the best. Believeth all things. Don't assume the worst in others like the Israel initially did. Number two, don't presume that your positions and conclusions are exclusively right. This young generation. Well, there's a lot of things that we do differently. But it doesn't mean one is right over the other. And it's wrong to presume so. That's what Israel did. Number three, go to others face to face when conflict arises. Number four, go to others lovingly with genuine desire for unity. And then number five, remember that our unity together is a witness of our oneness in God. May God help us. Whatever our brotherly relationships are, to put the guns down and go hug it out before somebody gets hurt.